Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of redefinedonline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks to Representative Randy Fine, chair of the Florida House Pre-K through 12 Appropriations Subcommittee. Representative Fine sponsored HB 7045 last legislative session, the landmark education choice expansion bill that streamlines the various choice programs in Florida and opens eligibility to nearly a million students in the Sunshine State. The two discuss Florida's role as a leader in education choice, the hope for greater bipartisan support for more options for families, and what lawmakers in other states can learn from Florida's success. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
So I'm very excited today to have Representative Randy Fine. Representative Fine represents District 53 in Brevard County in Florida. Representative Fine was a sponsor of House Bill 7045, which, as most of our listeners know, is one of the country's most important ed choice bills and certainly is being seen around the country as a historic piece of legislation. So welcome, Representative Fine.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, you had a pretty exciting session. Governor DeSantis signed the bill on May 11th. It makes over a million kids now eligible for scholarships in Florida. It also streamlines programs. We had a lot of complexity with multiple programs, and you guys have decided to make it more user-friendly. So talk a little bit about the motivation behind the bill. What were you trying to accomplish in the House? And I guess I also should mention, I'll get to this a little bit later, but really the Florida House has established itself over the last really two decades as the country's leading legislative body in the area of education choice. And I'm interested if you have any thoughts about how that happened. I mean, how is it that we ended up in the place where we are? But let me go back to the bill. What was the thinking behind 7045? What were you guys trying to accomplish as a legislative body?
Well, I think, you know, we've been on a school choice journey in Florida for more than 20 years. I think we're considered the leader in it. And I think every year we try to push the envelope even further and get more kids, because frankly, every parent should have the right to determine the best options for their child. And so we're on a pathway to ultimately move to a world in which every parent has the right to a voucher for their child or whatever the right school choice option for them. This is the latest iteration. And so we were very excited to be able to set a benchmark that says if you're a family of four making $100,000 or less, you can get a $7,000 voucher for each of those two children. So a family of four making $100,000 before taxes can now get $14,000 worth of vouchers to send their children to a private school if that's the right decision for them. And I think it's that continual movement towards creating more options and more choices and more control for parents.
How did the Florida House end up being the country's leading legislative body in ed choice? Do you have any sense of how that evolved?
Well, I think Florida at the end of the day is a fairly conservative state. I mean, you know, they say we're a purple state, but the Republicans seem to always win. And I think within that conservative state, the Florida House is the nexus of conservatism. And I think it started with Jeb Bush, you know, 20 plus years ago. And I think it's continued through every Republican governor that we have had since, trying to push the envelope. And so I just think we are a home of conservative ideals and conservative ideology. And whether it's school choice or taxation or regulation or have you, if you're looking for great conservative governance in the United States today, you're going to find no better state than Florida. And if you're looking for where the nexus of that conservatism comes from, it comes from the Florida House.
So you had some very powerful testimony, I think, in committee and on the floor about your own personal journey and how your life and your kids' life sort of led you to be one of the country's leading legislators in the area of education choice. Do you mind sharing that story with our listeners? I think they would be interested in hearing that story.
Sure. So I told the story of two boys. One boy grew up the son of a couple teachers. Family wasn't poor, but wasn't rich. This boy was a little different because he was a little smarter. Not the most athletic. He was a Jewish kid in a world that wasn't a super Jewish area. And when he was in middle school, he was tormented by the children that he went to school with, to the point where it wasn't safe for him to go to the bathroom at school. He had to use the teacher's bathroom, where he wasn't allowed to eat in the cafeteria with the other children because it wasn't safe. He ate in the teacher's lounge. And frankly, if it wasn't for those public school teachers, that boy might not have survived middle school. And his parents loved him. They're great parents, but you know, did not have the ability to get that boy out of that school and send him somewhere else. Then there was another boy that I talked about, another Jewish boy of the same age, 13 years old, whose parents got frustrated with the school that he was going to. The parents got angry about their son's teacher, and the principal told that boy's parents that he wasn't qualified to have an opinion about their son's education because he didn't have a degree in academic administration. And the minute that happened, that boy's parents, who were wealthy, took that boy right out of school and put him in a private school the next day. Why? Because they were rich. The first boy was me. The second boy is my son. And so I recognize the power of school choice to give parents the ability to protect their kids and make sure their kids live the best life. Look, I turned out okay. I mean, I ended up the valedictorian of my high school. I went to Harvard. I got 2 degrees. I had a very successful business career. So it made me tough. But you know, I believe that not everyone's me, and I think parents should have the ability, if their children are in a bad situation, to make a move. And I had that for my son. Paying the tuition was not a big deal for my family because I was a very successful businessman. But you shouldn't have to be rich to get a good education, and that's why this issue is so important to me.
Well, thank you for sharing that story. You obviously became really resilient, but as you said, a lot of kids don't survive that, and it's a shame that that we don't give kids options to protect themselves. And anyway, thanks for sharing. So one of the things that I'm noticing, but I wanted your feedback on this. I wrote a blog post a couple, maybe 3 weeks ago, talking about the fact that I think 70-45 begins a process that I call the normalization of education choice. It feels like for a long time, this was sort of a controversial, contentious program off to the side. But it feels like it's really starting to merge into public education. You had some comments on the floor where you talked about the fact that the idea that we think public education is only school districts is sure. really an outmoded concept. I want to talk a little bit more about that, but it really feels like to me that you guys are redefining the nature of public education, and you're now making it much broader, much more expansive. And it feels like that expansion is becoming increasingly normal. I mean, maybe I'm biased, but I'm curious your thoughts.
No. And look, the way groups have defined public education is actually a bastardization of its origins. You know, when Thomas Jefferson coined the term public education, what he meant was the education of the public. It wasn't the vehicle used to educate. It was the end goal. We want an educated public. And in fact, he believed that education should be run by parents. And by the way, if you can see elements of this in some school districts, you know, there still are some school districts around the country that are so small, they may have one high school and one middle school and a couple of elementary schools. And that's where that principle still stays, because the school districts are so small that everybody knows each other. Right. Then you get to a school district like mine, where you're in a county of 600,000 people, or Miami-Dade or New York City, where it simply becomes a bureaucracy. So what we're doing in Florida is we're returning to the notion of public education. The education of the public. We shouldn't care how a child gets educated, whether it's in a government-run school, whether it's in a privately run public charter school, whether it's in a private school, whether it's homeschool, whether it's a virtual school. Who cares? We, as long as the child is educated, and every kid is different, every vehicle is different, and our goal should be about the education of the public, not about the system by which the public is educated. And what we've seen in Florida is we have won that war. We are not in the legislature to fight for teachers' unions. We're not in the legislature to fight for bureaucrats, to fight for a system. We're there to fight for children. And I say all the time, I really don't care about the public, the government-run school system. I don't care if the whole thing collapses. That's not my job. My job is to make sure children get educated, and to make sure we have the best way to do that. And if that happens to be a government-run school, great. But if it doesn't, that's okay too.
How close are we to starting to get more sort of broad bipartisan support? You know, You and I both had the same experience where you'll talk privately to Democrats and they'll say, look, I get it. I got a lot of kids in my district. You know, I know this does a lot of good, but I'm going to stand up on the floor and demagogue it. I mean, am I being idealistic, overly idealistic and naive to think that maybe eventually, you know, everybody can say, okay, let's just focus on the kids and are we moving in that direction? Is that a possibility in Florida?
Well, we have a number of Democrats who support our school choice initiative, so it is bipartisan. I mean, I think it's universal among Republicans. It's a growing number of Democrats. I think the challenge is a political one. The largest source of financing for Democratic candidates in the state of Florida are teachers' unions. And so, you know, they are beholden to big money. And I think that's a big part of it, because, look, if the teachers unions have proven anything over the last 18 months, it's that they don't care at all about education. I mean, they have propagated the greatest state sponsored act of child abuse in the history of the world by having tens of millions of children not get educated for a year. I mean, if you think about the insanity that has gone on, where school districts have remained closed and these kids' lives will be altered forever because of selfish teachers unions who, bottom line, just didn't want to go to work and wanted to get paid. That's all it is. And so I think that has made that will have a transformative effect on school choice, because people no longer believe that the government-run school system actually cares about educating children. They've exposed themselves for the scam that they are over the last 18 months.
Let's talk about the future. You know, you talked about the journey of the last 20 years, and we're making a lot of progress. Have you started thinking about what your next legislative move might be? What's the next step in the EdChoice development in Florida to get to the goal that you've articulated?
Well, I think it's twofold. One is continuing to increase availability. You know, we're now at 375% of the federal poverty. It's about $100,000 for a family of four. Every year that all of our vouchers aren't used, that will pop up another 25%. Right. But look, I would like to see us in a world of universal choice. You should not be, if you're successful, you should not be punished by saying, no, you don't get to take your tax dollars with you. I think that's one thing. I think a second initiative, right now in our school choice programs, we're only providing the student with the state portion of the education spending. So we say the dollars follow the student, but they don't really. The state dollars follow the student. The local dollars that same family is paying still remain in the government-run school system. I think over time, I would like to see all of the dollars follow the system. So the school that I have one child in public school, one child in private school. The best private school in my county is fairly affordable given what many private schools cost. It's $11,000. The voucher is $7,000. We don't get the voucher, so for our family it doesn't matter, but if you did get, and there are many children who go to that school on a voucher, those families still have to come up with $4,000, despite the fact there are thousands of dollars more of funding that they're paying in local taxes that they're not getting. I think increasing the dollar amount, increasing the accessibility, that's the way that we ultimately continue to grow the program.
There's been a lot of dialogue between the House and Senate about how much flexibility that we give families to spend their money. The whole concept of education savings accounts is sweeping around the country. I know there's a lot of complexities in terms of making sure that those programs are run well. The Gardner program has been ESA for 6 years. We have the reading program for 2 years. What's your thoughts about managing that transition to make sure that we protect the public good and at the same time make sure that families, particularly low-income families, have the access to things, after-school programs, summer programs that your kids are going to have?
Yeah, and we have to balance that. You know, I want choice. I want parents to be able to make the right decisions for their families. But we also have to balance, you know, making sure that the money doesn't get spent in funky ways. And so I think there's opportunities on that as well. But again, when you're talking about $7,000 in the case of an income-based voucher, you know, that is going to be lucky to cover tuition. It's not as though there's lots of money hanging around afterwards to pay for summer programs. The Gardner scholarships, for example, are often a whole lot more because those are kids with special needs, so they get more money, and they may, and going to a school may not be the option to them. I guess a third opportunity that we didn't talk about, when I talked about increasing access, increasing money, I guess a third one that is in the back of my mind is some kind of homeschool scholarship. And I'm going to be working on that this summer. You know, I don't know that if you homeschool your kid, we need to give you $7,000. But it does bother me that a parent pays taxes to send their child to school, then chooses to take on the burden of educating that child themselves, and then has to go out and buy curriculum. You know, there's just something that's wrong about that. And so I don't know what the dollar amount would be or how we would make that work. But the idea of your expenses associated with homeschooling being able to be covered, again, I don't know that they need the full dollar amount to make that happen. Maybe it's $1,000 or $2,000, some sort of good faith amount of money. I think that's another opportunity that we have moving forward is to help homeschool parents who are choosing that. That's a form of school choice, making sure they have things covered as well.
Yeah, I can see an interesting debate over the next couple of years saying, you know, should a working class mom or dad who says, look, I'd like to stay home and teach my kids, but I can't afford to, but I can save the state a ton of money by doing it. Is there a deal to be had there to say, look, if you give me $3,000 or $4,000, that's enough money for me to stay home and pay the bills and educate the kid. Where if I send that kid to a school district, it's going to cost you $12,000 to educate that kid.
Yeah, I mean, look, any parent who says, if you give me $3,000, I can afford to stay home, I don't think is being honest. What it would be is, if you give me the $3,000, I'm not also then having to pay, you know, for the supplies out of pocket. I mean, look, part of public education is economies of scale. You're hiring one person to teach, you know, 20. A one-to-one education system would never be financially feasible. We do it sometimes for the extremely special needs kids, and I'm glad we do. But for sort of the routine run-of-the-mill child, I don't know that actually would work. But you know, I mean, I think that covering expenses so that they don't have to go and buy books for their child after choosing to homeschool them just strikes me as a matter of fundamental fairness.
Well, Representative, you've been generous with your time. You have really created a lot of dialogue around the country, I can tell you, because I flew a lot of those calls. So I appreciate everything that you've done in your leadership. Any final thoughts? Particularly, I mentioned earlier to you before the call that a lot of legislators around the country listen in and are interested in, you know, how do I replicate Florida's success? Do you have any advice for your legislators around the country, state legislators around the country who might want to, you know, replicate what you've been able to succeed in Florida?
Well, I'd say watch Florida. Use us as an example. We've shown that it works, and we've shown the benefits of it. I think part of the reason why we were able to get our government-run schools open, other than the fact we have a great governor, Ron DeSantis, is people knew there were so many choice options that the private schools could open, that the government-run schools had to open too. So watch us, use our story, because our story is an extraordinary one. But the other thing I would say is, you know, start small. You know, you're not. It's taken us more than 20 years. You know, Jeb Bush started this when he was governor, and it's taken us, we do a school choice bill virtually every year to expand it a little bit more. So you're not going to be able to go from zero to Florida overnight, but yeah. You know, start with special needs kids, start with the kids who are in failure factories, where the argument is just so overwhelming that it's hard to argue. And then, you know, we've now pushed well into the middle class. Our program is no longer a special needs or low income program. We are $100,000 family of four is not low. That is upper middle class, and that will continue to grow. So recognize you're not going to be able to get there overnight. And the other thing I would tell people is warn people. Our school system, I'll tell you a story. When I got worried about how the private school, I'm Jewish, as I mentioned, and I'm very close to the Jewish private day schools in Florida. And I was worried about what COVID would do to them. You know, I'm just, and I wasn't going to do anything politically. It's not the government's job to bail out private schools, but just as a Jew and someone who cares, I wanted to know how they were doing. So when COVID hit in the fall, I called and I said, hey, how are you guys doing on an enrollment basis? How you doing? And they said, we're exploding. We have to open another school. I said, what? I thought no one wanted to go to school. They said, no, people are moving from all over the country to come to Florida. So what I would tell legislators from around the country is be careful, be warned, because the story of Florida is out. And if you don't start to do what we're doing, your best athletes, your smartest kids, your families that care the most about education, they're going to move here. They're going to leave and they're going to come to a state that believes in parental choice, because Americans are mobile. You know, we can live anywhere we want. And we got 1,000 people moving to Florida every day. And many of them are moving to Florida because they want to put their kids in our schools and they want to take advantage of school choice. So there's another reason to do what we're doing, so you don't lose people to Florida.